Hi, everybody. Welcome back to WFAN's Baseball Insiders for Monday, December 6th. I'm Sweeney Murdy and joined by Ed Coleman. On Sunday, the Hall of Fame special committees announced their honorees, and there was a boatload of them. And that's a good thing as far as I'm concerned. Talk to Eddie about that in just a second. We've got a full Hall of Fame class and several months to celebrate them and get ready for induction, plus whatever happens in January with the writer's ballot. And that's always kind of touchy, and we're not sure if they're going to because there are going to be anybody added, but there certainly will be a celebration in Cooperstown this summer for many of the deserving candidates who were elected on Sunday. So, Eddie, I guess we should start with you with Gil Hodges, because there have been so many people around the Mets for a long time who've waited and waited and waited for Gil Hodges to get elected to the Hall of Fame, and the day finally came.
You know, I was humming an old song last night around the house by C.C. Peniston. I don't know if you remember. Remember, finally?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
To me. Yeah. And that's exactly what I thought of when Gil Hodges was finally inducted into the Hall of Fame. Long time coming for Gil Hodges. Should have happened a long time ago. And I think, you know, too, if you look at the numbers and the accomplishments that he got, he should have been in a long time ago. But there are others that probably fall in the same category. A tremendous honor. His wife, Joan Hodges, is 95. She's a great lady. And hopefully she's going to be able to make it to Cooperstown. She's just delightful. You know, two of the ladies that I've met over the years, Jackie Robinson's wife, Rachel, and Joan, are just terrific people. And I couldn't be happier for her and the family. You know, when you look at Gil, too, he had, you know, close to 1,300 RBIs, close to 400 home runs, close to 2,000 hits. You know, he was a little shy in those categories, but you know what? He was a terrific player and one of the mainstays of the Brooklyn Dodgers, along with Duke Snyder and others. A great manager who brought the Mets to a World Series title. And I always remember what Tom Seaver said about Gil Hodges. He said, you know, we wouldn't have gotten to where we got to in 1969. It was kind of improbable anyway, but he taught us how to be professionals. And he said, that's something that never left me in the rest of my career. He taught us how to go about being a ball player, coming every day, doing what you have to do, going through your routines. And that spoke volumes to me. If Tom Seaver was, you know, smart enough to listen to Gil Hodges, and Gil Hodges taught him that, and thus Tom Seaver had the kind of career he had, that spoke a lot to me. So never met Gil Hodges, but I think long overdue, and couldn't be happier for him and his family.
I'd like, you know, Jeremy Schapp has been tweeting out some comments from the book that Dick Schapp wrote with Tom Seaver, called The Perfect Game. Mm-hmm. And this was after the 69 season. I believe this came out in 1970, but I've got a copy of it here. But Seaver explains in the 1968 season, he had a game against Juan Marichal and the Giants where it was he was very tense in the game, gave a couple of home runs late, and the Giants won the game. The next time I started against Houston, I made up my mind that I was going to smile on the mound, be happy, enjoy myself. I beat Houston 5-3. The next day, Gil called me into his office. Tom, he said, your actions on the mound yesterday were uncalled for. You were laughing, grinning. That's unprofessional. I'd hate to see a person like you get a reputation for something like that around the league. Okay. I agree, I said, but I was so tight the other day, I wanted to make certain I stayed loose yesterday. I wanted to keep relaxed. Gil accepted my explanation. I remembered his advice. Here's the part that really sticks out to me, though. After telling that story, Seaver writes, Gil set rules, and his rules applied equally to every man in the club, whether he made $10,000 a year or $40,000. Think about that one for a second. He said, you made the bus on time. You got to the field on time. He played no favorites. If he thought you'd done something wrong, if you hadn't hustled, if you hadn't concentrated, he let you know. He didn't scream and he didn't yell, but he got his message across. And I love the way he articulates that, because a lot of times these days, Ed, we associate a manager doing these things with yelling and screaming, with making a show of some kind or showing emotion. Here's a guy who, universally respected and talked about for the last 50 years as a terrific and wonderful manager. And Seaver articulated to us his style, which was very low key.
No question. You don't have to turn over food tables to get your point across. And Gil Hodges always got his point across. He was respected. He was well respected by his players for good reason. There's no question. It brings to mind, too, you know, you telling that story about Tom and on the mound, that the story that Cleon Jones told, I think the last spring training I was at, which I can't even remember when that was, which was a couple of years ago with the pandemic. But Cleon was sitting in the dugout and he was talking about a huge series the Mets had with Houston, I think, at the time. And Cleon had a bad ankle. And he was in left field, and it looked like he kind of, you know, jaked it after a ball into the left field corner. But that wasn't the story. He had a bad ankle. He was having trouble running. But it looked that way to everyone in attendance and everyone that was there, that, you know, he didn't hustle for the ball in the left field corner. Gil Hodges came out of the dugout, walked out to left field, and took Cleon Jones out of the game. Now, the explanation that Cleon gave was after the game, you know, Gil said, I know you're hurting. He said, I know you were hurt. And I know that's the reason that happened. But, you know, he also said that appearances, you know, tell a lot. And I had to go out and do that. And I went out and did it because I know that you would understand. He was a leader on that team. And Gil went out and got one of the leaders. It wasn't a kid. Wasn't a rookie that he pulled out of the game. He went out and got Cleon Jones out of the game. And Cleon understood and he took it, but he told the story, you know, this much after the fact, well after the fact, whatever. And he said that's why he always loved Gil and respected Gil, because, you know, he treated everyone the same. It was, you know, 15-year veteran or 10-year veteran, whatever, and or rookie, it didn't matter. You had rules and you had the way to play the game, and Gil always enforced that.
And this is, again, also like, you know, reinforcing what has been celebrated for a very long time. The 1969 Mets are a special team. And as Seaver told you, they wouldn't have gotten there. They wouldn't, you know, their history is well documented. We all know it from 62 through 68 and everything that happened. And all of a sudden, everything flipped in 69. It's really one of the most legendary teams and seasons in baseball history. And, you know, there isn't a more respected player in Hall of Fame circles than Tom Seaver, you know, for just his play on the field and everything about him. And, you know, we've learned and talked a lot about him in the last year and change since his passing. But for him to say what he said about Gil Hodges just reinforces that to me and what that team is about and where it all started. And to think that it took this long, he first appeared in the Hall of Fame ballot in 1969 for his playing career.
Yeah,
and right. You mentioned some of the numbers that he almost came close to. I don't remember the exact number. I think he was like 11th or 12th on the home run list when he retired.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At that time. And that's really impressive. And you start to think about the era and the player in context to his era, because when we look at, you know, less than 400 home runs right now, you say, oh, well, why does that guy deserve to be in the Hall of Fame? But you think about that was a lot of home runs. And only as players started to get healthier and play longer careers because they were healthier, they start to eclipse those numbers with more regularity. I mean, Hodges did this basically in about his last 2 years were almost nothing. So he did this basically in about 15 or 16 years of a career, 15, I think, where he got almost 400 home runs. That's the context of the player.
I think that when he retired, Sweeney, there were only two right-handed hitters that had more home runs than Gil Hodges, Jimmy Fox and Willie Mays. Both guys are true Hall of Famers, to say the least. And I think that probably speaks volumes at that time. Now, other guys have passed him since that time, obviously. But, you know, Gil, it was just way too long for Gil Hodges not to be in the Hall of Fame. And it's like I said, I'm so happy that he's finally in. And one other thing I wanted to mention, too, Kudos to Jay Horowitz, our buddy and longtime Mets PR director, who was instrumental in always getting the buzz about Gil Hodges out there and always staying true to that and helping in any way he could to further, you know, the Gil Hodges, you know, train toward the toward the Hall of Fame. I wanted to mention him at that point in time. You know, another guy that we both know and love is in the Hall of Fame as well, along with Gil Hodges, and that's Kitty Cat, Jim Cott, who is one of the best person. You know, listen, he's one of the best people that I know, and I'm sure you feel the same way. Terrific player, terrific person. What is it, 288? Is that what he had, 288?
283.
Victories in his... 283. Yeah. 283. I was given five more for some reason. I don't know.
I think Tommy John is 288, right? Yeah.
Okay.
You worked with him, I think, for like he was, I think people forget, like in 87, he was doing shows at FAN.
Yeah, absolutely.
Doing World Series shows. He worked with Howie doing some shows in the World Series. And then he went on to this tremendous career as a broadcaster, too.
Yep.
And I think that helped us appreciate the pitcher because of all the tales he tells along the way. Listen, Jim Cott is a great example of what I feel like we all understand what the Hall of Fame, we need to understand what the Hall of Fame is about. And there are a lot of pitchers who in short periods of time were better pitchers. But the Hall of Fame, Ed, has they've every voting block for years and years has shown us that they are about longevity. It is not about short term. And that's a reason that a lot of people like Don Mattingly included and a lot of people haven't made it is because their careers were cut short. Jim Cott was ultra longevity. And I think he's even downplayed how great a pitcher he was. You had a chance probably to see him a lot more than I did. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if it hurt him along the way or not, but he always seemed to defer to his place in the arguments of, you know, Koufax and Gibson and Marichal and Seaver and Carlton and all those guys. And that's probably all true, but he played it down so much. I think it took away maybe some of the attention on how good he really was over a long period of time.
Yeah. Jim is, that's the type of person he is. He's very unassuming. He doesn't brag on himself. You know, he kind of lets his numbers and you know, his career speak for itself. And, you know, sometimes when you play in Minnesota all those years, you know, you're not as noticed. And those Twins teams, we'll mention Tony Oliva in a little bit, too. He was another guy, another Twin that went in into the Hall of Fame as well. But they were a great team, tremendous team. And Oliva was a big part of that. But Jim was just as big a part of that. And, you know, a tremendous anytime I see him, he always asks about Seoul, South Korea, because he was over there doing the Olympics. I was there at the time, and I would see him. He had the baseball broadcast over there, and he loved it. He loved doing it at the Olympics, and he always talks about going to Seoul, South Korea. And he said, "Remember Seoul?" I said, "Oh yeah, the kimchi, yeah, all the time." But Jim is—he's just a wonderful person, and I, you know, I said I couldn't be happier for Gil Hodges. I can't be happier for Jim Cott as well.
And I think a lot of it we talk about nowadays, like people kind of forget how to pitch, right? And a lot of the pitchers, the great pitchers that we talked about in the era, they were power pitchers, right? Like Gibson and Koufax and Seaver and all these guys. And we talk now about the lost art of pitching. Well, that was Jim Cott, right? He's not blowing anybody away. He was pitching, he was subtracting, and he was getting guys out.
And what we need are more Jim Cotts today for one big reason. Jimmy got it and threw it. Okay. He'd get the ball back on the mound and he would throw it. Okay. That's so, you didn't need a pitch clock with Jim Cott on the mound. He understood the art. Listen, I know what I'm doing out here. I know what I want to do on the next pitch. I'm going to get it. I'm going to throw it. And, you know, that didn't deter him from winning 283 games in his major league career. So it can be done without taking an eternity in between pitches and making 4-hour games these days. So I'm sure that, you know, Jim should have been put in charge, I think, of speeding the game up. I think we would have already been there by now.
And listen, if every pitcher could hit as well as Jim Cott, I would have no problem with, you know, DH would not be a thing, but you know, they all stink at it. So that's why we have a DH. And there's even, listen, he was such a good hitter, Eddie, His 1973 baseball card is pictured with him holding a bat. It's a pitcher at bat, and showing us his skills at the plate. And he was absolutely very proud of that over the years as well. We'll talk more about Cott as the months go along, because he is one of our favorites, and we've been in the business with him, and certainly one of the best people we've ever been around in doing these games. You mentioned Tony Oliva. Here's another guy that I didn't get a chance to see. I missed him by a little bit, but one of the great hitters who, again, his career longevity didn't get him to the numbers that we think of as automatics for Hall of Fame. Like his buddy Rod Carew got to 3,000 hits. Tony Oliva did not. But that shouldn't diminish. And now it finally doesn't diminish what he was as a player and a hitter.
You know, you mentioned, I was glad you mentioned Rod Carew, because when people think of the Twins and great hitters, the first name that comes to mind is Rod Carew. Now, Harmon Killebrew had over 500 home runs, but Tony was just as good a hitter to me as Rod Carew, with a little bit more power. Didn't have the longevity, as you mentioned, in the career, and didn't get to 3,000 hits, but he was a absolute pure hitter and just a dangerous guy, and a guy that, you know, with all the bats that the Twins had, I mentioned some of the guys, Killebrew and Allison and Jimmy Hall and others and Rollins, people like that. They had a lot of power hitters. The guy that you didn't want to see at the plate in a key situation was Tony Oliva. That was the guy, to me anyway, that would ultimately hurt you if you were a pitcher. And that's why I had all the respect in the world for Tony Oliva. He was just a tremendous hitter. And I think, you know, in the pantheons of, you know, Twins baseball, and maybe baseball in general, he kind of takes a backseat to some others like Carew. But he was just a flat out pure hitter and a tremendous player.
I think you and I kind of look at this the same way. You know, there are so many people who question the next level of Hall of Famers. You know, I think even Cott kind of mentioned this in one of his press conferences last night about the idea of, you know, you have certain guys and then there's another tier below that. And there's a segment of fans that doesn't like that other tier below that. Listen, I'm all for it. I understand that you're not going to let everybody in. You're not letting everybody in. You're just, if you're lowering the bar a little bit, you're getting a lot more really, really good to great players in there and making it a true celebration of the game. Because if we're waiting for those automatics, you know, you're going to go every 3 or 4 years and put one person in. That's not what this should be. This should be, you know, the more people like these guys that we put in, the more I think we appreciate how good and how great the game has been for a long time and what their achievements were in their time.
That's a great point, Sweeney, and also easy to segue into another guy who goes into Minnie Minoso. The reason I always loved Minnie Minoso, first and foremost, was his name. For whatever reason, I just loved saying the name Minnie Minoso, the Cuban Comet, as they used to call him. And I didn't see him a lot, again, because back in the day, even though I was around at that time, you know, you had maybe a game of the week, possibly. And, you know, I'm not sure how often the White Sox were on, because that's where he spent most of his career. He was with Cleveland. But Minoso was a terrific player, an absolute terrific player. He would never be afraid to try to steal a base, although he got thrown out an awful lot trying to do that. Yeah. But, you know, when you look back, you look at, and again, OPS and on-base percentage were not things that were highlighted at that point in time. Minnie Minoso, he played 20 years. He had six seasons, full seasons, where he had an on-base percentage over 400. Not 380, not 370. I think his career was like 370 on-base percentage. But he had six seasons over 400, like 420, 440. I'm saying, whoa. He was just a terrific player, good defensive player as well, too, and just a fun guy to watch, and a guy that I think should be celebrated and deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. But, you know, as you mentioned, that might be one of the guys, you know, a guy in the other tier, you know, well, is he really worthy, whatever? Well, I say, yeah, I think he is. And it's a great way to celebrate the game with not just the guy who had a catchy name and also known as the Cuban Comet. He was a terrific player. Minnie Minoso was a very good player.
And those four that we talked about, Hodges, Cott, Minoso, Oliva, they'll be joined by the two selections from the other committee that was from the early baseball era and includes the Negro League contributors, Bud Fowler, Buck O'Neill. I think a lot of us who watch, you know, whether it's Ken Burns Baseball or any of their specials over the years about different things in baseball, we knew Buck O'Neill's place in it and how he kind of spanned generations and his lengthy contributions over the course of time, as especially as an ambassador to the game, and the fact that he has a spot. I didn't remember this. There's a statue of Buck O'Neill in the Hall of Fame, but he wasn't actually a member of the Hall of Fame yet. So that was kind of odd. So this kind of writes that and just adds to what I think we already know is a Hall of Fame personality. But Fowler is the kind of guy, Eddie, that I like when these guys are elected because I know nothing about them, and it gives me an opportunity to learn who they are, what they were, why they were important, why I should know them. I'm supposed to know these guys because they were great players in the sport that we watch and grow and follow. And I'm looking forward to the opportunities to read and learn more about Bud Fowler between now and next summer.
Yeah, listen, Bud Fowler is a guy that most of us that even follow the game are not that familiar with, obviously, from the Negro Leagues. Buck O'Neill, we know because of the name. And Buck is one of the more, I always thought, one of the more eloquent spokespersons for the game of baseball. I mean, and the thing that always impressed me about Buck is there was never, he never felt sorry for himself. He never... I think he realized he deserved to be in the Hall of Fame, but he never called it out that way. He was just a guy that wanted to be a great baseball player, was a great baseball player. It was a different time, a different era. He kind of understood that. I think he's obviously, deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. And as you mentioned, his statue was already in there. But, to me, in listening to him over the years, he was always very eloquent about the way he spoke about the game and his place in the game and the place of a lot of his teammates that, probably deserve to be there as well.
I think it's always important to make sure we talk about the guys that got in first. It's always about this is about celebrating the people who got in. But along with that, it's always about who didn't or came close and didn't or deserve or, you want another shot. You and I spoke a lot about Dick Allen a year ago when he came close to one of their ballots and then he passed away. He unfortunately came up one vote short again. And he would have been able to join this tremendous class. He's in one of these weird areas because I think his career was 15 years. So if he goes an extra couple of years, it probably already happens. And there are other factors with Dick Allen, but clearly everybody understands the type of player he was, the impact he had, and how great he was, because two ballots in a row, he's come up one vote short. It shows you what an impossibly high standard 75% can be. And obviously it should be high if you're talking about Hall of Fame. But so many people you and I run into and talk to, Dick Allen's a Hall of Famer, yet here we are today and he's not one.
It's interesting that I believe he is in the Negro Hall of Fame. I believe he is in, I believe that he also said that was what counted to him. He was in the Hall of Fame already in the Negro League Hall of Fame, and that mattered more to him, maybe because he wasn't in the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. I don't know. I don't know the reason, but it's interesting, Sweeney, in this day and age where we it's strikeout, home run, it's all about the ultimate. This was one of the true sluggers of the game. I mean, Dick, you stopped when Dick Allen came to the plate, and that's to me, that has always been a calling card for great players in baseball. If you have to stop doing what you're doing, or you're not going to miss an at bat for a person, that's a guy who belongs in the Hall of Fame and is a guy that deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. I was stunned when he wasn't for this class. But again, one vote, which is frustrating and I think almost criminal. But Dick Allen deserves to be there, and I don't know if that's going to happen in the future or not, but hopefully someday it will.
I was a little shocked to see Roger Maris didn't get more support. I know that, you know, and again, these guys are all guys who there are certain things that have kept them out of the Hall of Fame. Mostly, most of it is longevity. And it's about the idea of the lengthy career not matching up with the lengthy careers of others. So you've had other opportunities. Obviously, the numbers and stats don't change. It's just a matter of seeing if a different voting block, given more perspective, gets a chance to appreciate that career a little bit differently than maybe a voting block from 20 years ago. And it's still kind of not there. A terrific player. Injuries certainly hurt him later in his career, but he had two phenomenal seasons, MVPs, breaking the home run record in 61, part of World Series champions, both in New York and in St. Louis, a tremendous defensive player. I'll get to that in a second. But Maris comes up short again, and he wasn't really close, which leads me to believe there's probably not going to be any sort of committee that's going to get him in if he hasn't really been close in any of these elections.
You had a great stat. And in this day and age of sluggers and the ultimate, you know, either home run or a strikeout, 61 home runs in 1961 and 67 strikeouts, I believe, right? Yeah. That's amazing. I've always felt with Maris that the 1 year and the home run chase with Mantle actually hurt him in the long run, because that's what everyone focuses on with Roger Maris, is that I guess the exclusion of almost everything else that happened in his career. He was a very good player. And as you mentioned, he went to St. Louis. They were a World Series champion there, as well as being one with the Yankees. Did he ever approach, the home run total that he had in New York? No, but he was a very good player for the Cardinals as well. And I think a very good player for his career. But I've always felt that season in particular, the race with Mantle and trying to catch Babe Ruth, hurt him in the long run. Mantle is, a name that's, it's folklore in the game of baseball. Everyone knows Mickey Mantle. And Roger Maris was kind of, the 1A to Mantle's one that year, even though Maris was the one who broke the record. But at the same time, I always felt that hurt him in the long run, simply because people focus so much on that to the exclusion of everything else that happened in his career.
So we've mentioned Gil Hodges, who obviously is Brooklyn Dodger, but has a very deep connection with the Mets. We mentioned Roger Maris, who has a long connection with the Yankees. As we move forward, I'm not sure if this is the next ballot or not. I should know this, but I don't. But as you move to the other eras, we're going to get back at some point in time to discussing candidacies of a Met and a Yankee with some deep ties. Keith Hernandez and Thurman Munson, two guys who've come up short in their elections. Let's start with Hernandez, because I mentioned this yesterday. I tweeted out this thing about defense. We talk a lot of times about defense. The Gold Glove leaders at every position are in the Hall of Fame except for first base. Keith Hernandez, 11 Gold Gloves, is the Gold Glove leader at first base. Now, mm-hmm. He wasn't a Punch and Judy hitter either. He's got a batting title, an MVP, two World Series championships. There's a lot there to say, of course, he belongs in the Hall of Fame, but he's not there yet. I think the defense has... We talk so much about importance of defense, but when it comes time to rewarding greatness, we focus solely on the offense. And I think it shortchanges Keith, especially in this instance.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that Keith will be there eventually. I do think that people will come around in that regard. I think he has a very varied resume. He was an excellent first baseman. He's, kind of been the poster child for defensive first base over the years. I remember when I grew up, Vic Power was a guy, speaking of another Minnesota Twin for a while. He was also an Indian too. But Keith, I think, has had over the years. Very good hitter. Had power as well. Not a lot of power, but he had power. Accomplished a lot on the field as far as championships, with a couple of World Series champions. So I think Keith is there. Maybe I'm a little biased because I see Keith a lot as a Met broadcaster, but at the same time, I think he will get in eventually. With Munson, it's interesting. I've always felt that he'll be a little bit short, not that he shouldn't be there, but kind of the Mattingly syndrome, I guess, a little bit in that sense. The years that he had that were great were tremendous, just not enough of them. And the career wasn't long enough, unfortunately, in his case.
Yeah, and I don't know, like, and there's really no way of knowing how much longer Munson's career would have gone, because, you know, the whole story about him is like he wants to be more closer to his family, wants to spend more time with them, and the whole idea of getting the plane and being able to go back and forth. So and physically, the toll it was taking, he was already having issues with his knees and his body and trying to stay behind the plate. So how much longer could he have gone? What would that have done to his career? Would he have had a bunch of years where he was still really good, or would he have a bunch of years where his performance dipped and it affected his overall career? I don't know what the right answer is there, because, you know, it's all hypothetical. It ended August 2nd, 1979, and that's all we have to go on. He has a lot of great, great points to put in his Hall of Fame resume. Again, you're talking about somebody who it hasn't happened for any variety of reasons. He's pretty much almost, I mean, he's what? He's basically 10 years shorter of a career than on a ballot than Gil Hodges. Gil Hodges put a ballot in 69, Munson shortly after, you know, his death in 79. So, I don't know if he's ever going to get there, but there's going to be candidacy. I think it's part of the fun's a wrong word when you're talking about it this way, but it's part of the great fun we have as baseball fans talking about the players that we saw and bring them up again. I say to people who unfortunately dropped off the ballot, I say, I don't know if you're a Hall of Famer, but I hope you stay on the ballot, because I think the great reward you have is having everybody discuss your career every year as you're on the ballot and talk about how great you were, because that is a special achievement. And whether you make it to the Hall of Fame or not, having everybody relive your career on a ballot is pretty special. Unfortunately, it happens every so often now with the players in these Veterans Committee ballots. This is a really long way of me saying, I don't know if Munson's going to get into the Hall of Fame, Eddie, because I think the shortness of his career has really impacted that.
Yeah, no, it has. An 11-year career, obviously, and listen, there were some very good years there as well. And I think we all know what kind of backstop that he was. And he was the backbone of those Yankee teams. I mean, he was the guy, he was the captain. But at the same time, I do think, unfortunately, the short career is going to hurt him in the long run. But it's a good point you bring up about, the fact that we can continue to talk about these guys, because that was the way for Gil Hodges for years. We would talk about, what kind of player he was, what kind of manager he turned into, what kind of leader he was. I think all those things apply to Munson, maybe not the managerial part, but obviously those things apply to Munson as well. It's just unfortunate that the career was cut short the way it was.
There's a writer's ballot that's due in January, and we'll have time to dissect all that, because that's got a lot of interesting points to it. And we'll see if anybody joins this wonderful group of six people that were elected to the Hall of Fame on Sunday in these special Veterans Committee ballots.
You mean there won't be a lot of movement in the negotiations before that comes out?
I was going to get to that. We might have to discuss some more of those things too, but that's really boring. This is the fun stuff, talking about great players and stuff, Hall of Fame, things like that. So we'll get to the boring stuff maybe next week. We've got a lot more to come in the coming weeks, even though there is a lockout going on. We'll keep diving into some stuff. So come on back, subscribe to WFAN's Baseball Insiders, where you get your podcasts. He's Ed Coleman. I'm Sweeney Murdy. Thanks for listening.